Lucas can hit him. And he's hit it beautifully!
A magnificent goal! A hugely important goal! And here at home, whatever the odds at the moment, they seem to find a way.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the flashback series of podcasts from the Tigers Down Under. I'm your host, Alex, and with me I have Logan. How are you, Logan?
Yeah, good afternoon, Alex. I'm doing pretty well. It's quite a nice time of year to reflect on some of the previous seasons, but particularly this one. I think that I saw the title of the podcast, Marco Silva's Lone Army. It brought back a few fond memories, and a couple of pretty exciting goals. So lots to talk about, and it's quite nice to take a walk down memory lane.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, we had the goal there in the introduction from Sam Clucas against Watford, which probably stands out as one of the best, I suppose, in terms of technical quality goals that we had scored that season. And also, I suppose, reflecting specifically on that game, we had the red card early on for Umar Nias, sort of win that game 2-0 and really give ourselves a shot at staying up. Summed up the spirit of the fighting spirit that Silva actually got into the side in that second half of the season. So, yeah, as you said, lots to talk about. We'll jump into it with, the man, the myth, the legend himself, Marco Silva, taking charge in January once Mike Phelan had been sacked following that 3-1 loss to West Brom at the start of January. What struck me, first of all, with this one was how quickly the appointment was made. I think you were on the first half of this season review as well, where we talked about how long it took for Phelan's appointment to be made permanent, having been the caretaker for much of the first half of that season. But then it was clear that the owners, the Alums, had lined up Silva sometime before making that decision with Phelan, because he came in only, I think it was literally a day or two after Phelan was sacked. So I don't know if you can cast your mind back to that appointment and what your thoughts were of Silva coming in.
Yeah, well, I think the very first thing that kind of stood out to me when I saw the appointment was, how incredibly young Marco Silva was. I know that he was a manager that was receiving a fair few accolades, but it just seemed like a really, a gutsy one to have so much confidence in a young manager of such in the form of Marco Silva. I remember that there was a few things that I really liked about his appointment once it happened, and he was kind of brought in that approach. And I think I may have mentioned this on the first half of this season, but just the professionalism and the way that kind of he would prepare for matches. And I remember there's the talk about him running a fine-tooth comb over the players' diets, and sort of just the preparation and the way that we would travel to games. And it was just a really interesting kind of revolutionary approach compared to what, City had been used to. So I remember those things standing out, and obviously the very large backroom staff that he also brought with him, which, also resulted in some pretty, extravagant goal celebrations, which was always, pretty good to for the fans to see, I guess.
Yeah, it was funny because I remember correctly, he'd put an application in to become our manager at the start of the season, and Ehab had sort of dismissed it as a potential applicant, whether it was because, he'd only really managed over in Portugal, I suppose, but also at Olympiacos, and Ehab wasn't really too familiar with him, whatever the case may be. Clearly by January, we were a bit more desperate perhaps, and Marco was still sort of looking for a club to make that break into England. And it was clear he had these ambitions to manage in England, and as we've seen him go on to manage Watford, Everton, and now, of course, being quite successful with Fulham. I was sort of thrown by the fact that, he took that time off from Olympiacos, learned English, really committed himself to coming over. In a similar way, we'll talk in the next episode about Leonard Slutsky, almost as if we tried to replicate the magic by going after Slutsky and following that sort of mold of a manager. But as you said, Silva, with that attention to detail, I think they banned the apple crumble from the team cafeteria, which wouldn't go down well these days with the quality of food that we're producing. But his attention to detail was certainly something that shone through, and we sort of touched on before, his ability to get the players up and really believing that we could stay up that season. I suppose the other big context of that second half of the season was, and we'll talk in more detail in a bit about the incomings and outgoings in the squad, but I suppose just sort of talking broadly about the transfer policy, it did seem as if we shifted quite significantly from that approach in the summer window, where we brought in, you know, Keane and Weir and stuff like that on deadline day just about, to actually kind of going out and getting quite recognisable names. And I wonder a little bit if that was because of the pull of Silver and perhaps the Alums trusting him a bit more with that budget than they might have with Phelan.
Yeah, potentially. That might be one of the arguments. I think that it's, as I kind of, you know, reflect on these historical podcasts and we go back through the years, I think we'll never really know, you know, just what the kind of conversations were that went on in the background and how frustrating, you know, the Alums potentially were to work with as far as, you know, them being the owners of the club and controlling those transfer budgets. Because as you say, like, it certainly appears like Marcus Silva was given a little bit more leeway or trust, I guess, than what, you know, than Mike Phelan was. But obviously in the manner that Steve Bruce left as well, there seemed to be always this kind of overarching, it was the word I was looking for, view of you know, of frustration. And everyone seemed to kind of start with a seemingly working relationship, and then things turned pear-shaped pretty quickly. And, you know, as you know, the future, you know, tells us, or history tells us, when we look back on this, the same kind of thing seemed to happen with Marco Silva. But you are right in the sense that initially it did appear like there was a larger sense of optimism with the Silva appointment, and he was given a little bit more free rein, which is interesting.
Yeah, and then I guess the only other sort of contextual element to touch on this season, which was more of a negative one, was, of course, the incident with Ryan Mason at Chelsea. The quite a serious head injury from the collision with Gary Cahill, which ultimately spelled an end to his career. I can't actually remember, did he ever actually make another appearance for us with that helmet, or was that just sort of talked about for quite a while and then dismissed?
Yeah, I don't think so. I think what initially happened was the club got pretty excited about, you know, kind of an immediate return. And I remember they released a few training videos of Ryan Mason, you know, kind of getting around the pitch. And I think they may have even interviewed him, and he was just talking about, you know, his excitement for getting back. And it really did appear, look, the way that he was going to be making a return at some point before, you know, his hopes were dashed. And yeah, that all happened really quickly. And I think when he got the news, I think he went and saw another specialist or something, and then was hit with the, you know, with the really disappointing news of his future, and that kind of spelled the end of his career. But yeah, I certainly I don't recall. I mean, I'd be really surprised if he played once, but I don't think so.
Yeah, I just had in my mind that they talked a long time about getting this helmet that he could wear or that sort of thing. But yeah, you're right, I don't think he actually did. So it was a really disappointing end to his career. Obviously, you know, paramount importance was that he's now, you know, happy and healthy and safe, and, you know, great assistant manager to Big Ange at Spurs, which is great to see. But I'm sure for him it was a really frustrating way to sort of curtail that quite promising career. So it you know, without making it sort of about City more so than Ryan, it is quite crazy to consider how many of those sort of freakish injuries we seem to have had with quite some promising players in the side. I mean, Snodgrass did really well to come back from his knee injury, but you consider guys like Odubajo and more recently Josh Emmanuel as well, who seem to have had a few different issues that you wouldn't call sort of standard football injuries that seem to have really curtailed quite promising careers.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one of the things that's even more interesting about the Ryan Mason one is I'm almost certain at the point of his career when we signed him, he was our record signing. And I think it was, like 12 or 13 million pounds. It was something quite substantial. Yeah. And, you know, again, that kind of feeds into this strange narrative of whether the Alums were investing or not, because that, to me, you know, it's a bit of a head scratcher that they've got that sort of budget to, you know, to take a punt on a player of Ryan Mason's caliber, but then it's also partnered with some, you know, I respectfully say, some hugely underwhelming signings as well. So yeah, very, very interesting times. And yeah, as you said, I just, one of the things with Ryan Mason, I do remember that signing being a huge, you know, kind of cause for optimism in the club, thinking that particularly the start of the season when there wasn't really the troops around, and we thought, oh, well, at least there's, like, you know, a little bit of a chance with Ryan Mason and some of the other players of that caliber that were coming in. He was certainly the pinnacle of that, but for him to, you know, not be able to play as much as we hoped, I was very disappointing way to, you know, to end his career, and for City as well, because I would have loved to have seen, you know, Ryan Mason go around in a City shirt, as we all would have, but certainly would have been a big statement of intent.
Absolutely. Well, we'll talk about some of those other signings now. We'll start with the permanent signings. And to be honest, this whole podcast could be just about dedicated to all of the incomings that we had that window, because between the permanent loan signings that we had, there was quite a few new faces into the club. And it's interesting, starting with these permanent signings in Evandro and, you know, Kamil Grzycki, who I sort of see this as the end of one era of City and the start of the next, because, of course, we'll talk a bit later on about Bowen getting his first start for City at the end of the season. But between Bowen and Grzycki, it really sort of symbolised the next 3-4 years of City and, of course, this podcast series going up to the end of the 2020 season when Bowen and Grzycki were sold. It's sort of this is sort of that final third of that decade and the players that really embodied it. But Evandro is a funny one as well, and maybe we start with him, because he was one of those sort of stereotypical players that seemed to follow Marco Silva everywhere he went and signed for us from Porto, I believe, where Silva had been manager before Olympiacos, but then stuck with us after Silva left. And, you know, he was one of those players that seemed to just kind of get hammered by hamstring injuries or soft tissue injuries. But when he was fit, was a really sort of integral part of the team. And I think City even posted a video the other day of him scoring a goal against Aston Villa to, I think, put us 2-0 up in what was at that point a really crucial game to potentially make the playoffs. And so you sort of forget that he did hang around the side for quite a while after this season, just couldn't really string the games together.
I recall Evandro, because I'm almost certain that on a podcast, maybe it was a season launch, when we were talking about the players in the squad, there was like a contention whether he was still in the squad or whether he'd been moved on. And that, to me, you know, there wouldn't be too many players in over 10 years that we've been doing the podcast for. I think it's been about that long that we would have, you know, had to scratch our heads as to whether this player is on the books or not. And Evandro certainly fitted that mold. And I agree. I thought he was, as you said, there was those hamstring injuries which made things, you know, incredibly interesting. But he did have some really strange periods where he, you know, remained fit for a while and was very influential, and just seemed to be one of those real, like, you know, workmanlike players who was kind of no fuss, like really, you know, was quite a solid footballer. And obviously Marco Silva had raps on him to take him everywhere, as you said, but he didn't command a big fee, and you know, as you said, ended up staying on longer than what anyone really would have expected, without really setting setting the stadium alight. He was a you know, an imperative part of this period, and one of the more experienced players that we did have. So it's an interesting player to reflect on.
Yeah, and then of course Grzycki ended up with 24 goals with us in his 119 appearances, which, again, you sort of, I mean, and you touched on before the fact that we spent 13 or 14 million on Ryan Mason. We spent 7 million on Grzycki as well. So it's easy to kind of get lost in that sea of loanees that came in that window, that we did actually have a pretty serious outlay on a couple of players as well, and Grzycki being sort of chief among them. I guess my overriding memory of he I put in the same sort of category as Hernandez, where I think the club actually got more service out of them than they would have expected, because I think at one point, more specifically with Hernandez, he got injured when the club was trying to sell him, and so he stuck around. But I remember there was that one window where Grzycki was sort of live tweeting the close of the transfer window, thinking he might get a club interested in buying him, and Myler came out and said, "Go to bed, Turbo, nothing's happening," sort of thing, which was quite funny. But he turned into sort of an unexpected club legend in a way with the contributions he made over those championship seasons.
I'm glad that you remembered the David Myler incident, because I remember there being some kind of shadow around Grzycki always being linked elsewhere. And I was like, what was it? And when you said David Myler, it straight away tweaked that was exactly the thing that happened. Yeah, I agree. I think Turbo Gross was one of my fondest, you know, player memories, is thinking back through the years of just how much he did. And, you know, we don't want to jump too far ahead and talk about the next couple of years period, but there was a stage where it legitimately felt like if we were going to compete or win a game, it was going to be purely based on how Gwizdicky played and how Jared Bowen played. Like the role that those two had in both the goals that they would either score or assist to the other one was just remarkable. And as you said, like for someone who was forever being linked away from the club, to have played as many games as he did and also have as many influential stats like goals and assists that he did, when his head was screwed on, he was an incredibly exciting player to watch. And yeah, ended up being at the club for a lot longer than many of us would have expected. And yeah, I have very fond memories of him. You're right. It's a weird one. It's one of those like kind of lower tier club legends, but he's certainly in the conversation for, you know, the last 20 years. Like he'd be in the top, I don't know, 30 to 50 City players without a doubt.
And then I couldn't fit all of the let's see if I skip ahead. Couldn't fit all of the loanees on the same page because we actually had five come in. I've only got four listed there. We've got Nias, El Abdelawi, Markovic, Ranocchia, and then of course we also had Ndiaye come in from Villarreal, I think it was. As sort of the five loanees parachuted in to try and save the season. And I think probably of the five of them, Ranocchia coming in from Inter Milan was probably the most amazing one to come in with the reputation that he had and the caliber that he brought. But I think in their way, I mean, El Abdelawi perhaps the least, but I think in their way, each of them did actually have quite a significant contribution to us almost staying up that season.
Oh, absolutely. And I think the one that stands out for me, it's interesting. It's probably up to the, you know, the individual and how they remember the period and kind of what they look for, the traits. But for me, Lazar Markovic was the one that kind of stands out. And that was purely based on the fact that, you know, he was a player who certainly came with, you know, was touted to have a huge pedigree and, you know, obviously didn't have the influence at Liverpool that perhaps was expected. And I just remember there was a period, again, injury prone to a certain extent, but Marco Silva seemed to get the best out of him. I'm pretty sure that was played the highlight clip from with Sam Kluskas' goal. I'm certain it was that the Swansea game that he just set the game alight as well. And there was two or three really crucial games.
Well, I think he got the first goal in the Watford game as well.
Watford definitely was one of the fixtures, but remarkable and just blinding pace. I really enjoyed watching him play. And then I guess you mentioned Ranocchia. I don't think I'll ever forget the assist of Ranocchia bombed it over the top of the Liverpool defensive line, I think, where Nias ran onto it. And I think we won that game 2-0. But he certainly was another player that I thought we might have been able to convince him to stay around, but it wasn't the case. But yeah, like I said, there's some really interesting moments. And in, as you kind of cast your eyes on the screen caption and see the players, they all did do, you know, some pretty incredible highlight moments. It's just a shame that it wasn't enough in the end, but
it's such a sliding doors moment as well, where you sort of have to think if we had stayed up that season that you'd expect maybe two or three of these, maybe even four of them would have become permanent signings in the summer. And you think not just for us, but also for these players, the career trajectories that they may have had, because as you touched on with Markovic, but also Nias, I mean, I think Nias is playing lower league English football now. I think he's in League One or League Two, perhaps. So yeah. It's not as if these players have sort of gone on to bigger and better things necessarily. They've not necessarily hit the heights that they did during those loan spells, where I sort of look at a Markovic is probably the prime example, as you touched on there, that he had such a successful loan spell that you can't help but think if we'd been able to stay up and keep him on, his career really might have kicked on in a much stronger way than it did.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, it's very strange talking about this group, because very rarely do you remember lone players who have only been there for, you know, when we talk like half a season or I guess one full season before they take off. And none of these, you know, players stayed on for an extended period of time at City. I think perhaps maybe Abdelawi might have stayed the longest out of this as I kind of cast my mind back. But yeah, exactly right. It would have been one of those really interesting moments for them. If we had have stayed up and they had have got, you know, City contracts, would that have been the kind of thing that kept them in the limelight? Because as you said, I don't think anyone's career's kind of, you know, peaked from here. Potentially Ranocchi is, but I think outside of that, it's really interesting that, yeah, as you said, the importance of a relegation fight and what it can mean to players' careers probably often isn't spoken about enough.
Yeah, no doubt. And then these moves were somewhat funded by departures of two sort of, you know, City favourites in a way, in Jake Livermore and Robert Snodgrass. Livermore going to West Brom, where, you know, in a way he's become more synonymous with West Brom than he was at City, despite having quite a successful career with City, and now playing at Watford. And Snodgrass recently announced his retirement, but went from us to, I think it was West Ham, had a loan spell at Villa, and then I think went back to Scotland after that. But I think we got about £10 million for each of them, which was quite good. You know, there was also a bid in from Burnley from Burnley for Andrew Robertson that window, which Silver basically just rubbished because he saw the value in Robertson. I can't help but feel that the offer that we eventually got in the summer from Liverpool wasn't a whole lot better than what we were probably offered by Burnley, but I'm glad to have held on to him at least for the rest of that season. But yeah, Livermore and Snodgrass's departures and what you made of them.
Well, I think the thing that I will say about Jake Livermore is I think that he will probably be remembered for his time in a City shirt, mainly because he came across with Tom Huddleston. And I do remember being over there and seeing some games in this period, and everyone was, oh, the Tottenham boys was how they were kind of referred to. Mm. So the interesting thing about that is, as you mentioned, yeah, like Livermore certainly probably does have a greater reputation from a West Bromwich Albion standpoint now, but I think he will always be remembered for how kind of critical that you know, that transfer was, and the fact that it did come with no less than Tom Huddleston. I think Robert Snodgrass was a really interesting one for us because he was someone who I remember, I dare say, admired at Leeds, only because he was such a prolific goal scorer in the Championship. And I remember how much of a big coup it was when we, you know, were able to sign him. Obviously, like, free kick specialist and just a very influential player. And again, you want to talk about, you know, City having bad luck. And then there was obviously the kneecap incident, which kept him out for an extended period of time, which, you know, probably you know, cast a little bit of a shadow on his City career, because if that didn't happen, you know, he was certainly a player who was very lively, and as far as a numbers standpoint, had a really incredible, you know, football career. And it was a shame that we didn't get.
Yeah, no, I was just gonna say, it's easy to forget as well. I think he was, might have been our top goal scorer that season, because he obviously got the goal against Leicester.
Yep.
Excuse me, got a goal against Southampton as well to win us a game. So he had some pretty crucial goals in this season as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, as one of those ones as well, where I when you think about, like, Steve Bruce obviously built a little bit of an Irish contingent. There was the Rob Snodgrass and Andy Robertson with the Scottish
Sean
connection.
Sean Maloney as well, yeah.
Sean Maloney is another one. So it was really interesting to see, you know, Snodgrass and I guess the time he spent at City, but, you know, fantastic player, and you know, what a great achievement that, you know, or thing that we get to say that we got to see him in a City shirt.
Absolutely. Well, then, yeah, we'll reflect on some of the key games from that second half of the season as we wrap this up. We sort of already touched on that 2-0 win over Liverpool. That probably stands out in my mind as the key game in that second half of the season. I think that Watford game as well, that we sort of reflected on at the start of the episode as well, was really the one, because I sort of forget until I look back at the, I suppose, the table positions as we finished off that season, that we were actually outside the relegation zone for about five games in a row from, you know, we won the two games in a row against West Ham and Borough, which pulled us out of the relegation zone. And it was really only then when we lost to Sunderland with three games to go that we slipped back into that relegation zone. And my memory is sitting down to watch that game against Crystal Palace as the second last game of the season, knowing basically that if we won it, we were likely to stay up. And if we lost, you know, it was going to take a lot to get over Tottenham in the last game of the season. And I suppose the disappointment for me was the manner in which we lost that Palace game 4-0. I know there was a lot of rumours after the season finished and Silver went off to Watford quite quickly that potentially he'd already had his head turned by them in those closing weeks of the season, and that might have had a bearing on the team. But It was a very disappointing fall off in those last two games.
Yeah, as you mentioned, that the whole the Sunderland game was probably the key moment in the season. Mm-hmm. When you think about it in hindsight, the fact that, you know, we were playing Sunderland, a fellow, you know, relegation scrapping team, that, you know, on paper you wouldn't really have said that there's too much about them, and we did have it at the, you know, MKM as well, and to lose 2-0, that kind of to me was the tipping point where I felt like if we couldn't win that game, then it was very unlikely that we're going to stay up. I know that, as you said, the Crystal Palace game certainly had that feeling, like you just never know what could happen, but if we had taken 3 points against Sunderland, I think we probably would have been able to relax for those last two games. And, you know, as fate has it, I think we ended up conceding 11 goals in the remaining two fixtures and maybe scored one. But, you know, incredibly disappointing way. But certainly that Sunderland game stands out. And it was amazing to me that it had such a football omen. It almost felt exactly the same as that game against Burnley that we lost potentially 4-1 on. It was like the same type of season against the same type of team. And, you know,
the late season win against Liverpool to give us hope, and then the losses to Sunderland and Burnley's and those sorts of sides to kill us off. It did feel like both the Bruce season and the Silver season relegation from the Premier League came in a very similar way, which is quite frustrating. And I was just looking at the results. I'd almost forgotten as well that 0-0 draw with Southampton. I don't know if you recall, we conceded a penalty in, I think, must have been the 91st, 92nd minute, and Jakupovic saved the penalty to give us the 0-0 draw. And that felt like one of those games. It sort of reminds me of the Middlesbrough game this season with Allsop making those triple saves where all the players rush to them and you kind of have that moment of unity and spirit and everything. You think, okay, this is a good moment to kick us on and keep us up. But unfortunately, was followed up with that Sunderland loss, as you said, which basically killed us off.
Yeah, and interestingly, as I just quickly have a scroll back as well, and, you know, we talked about that Watford game before with the incredible goal that Sam Kluger scored, and Markovic did score the goal before. Also forget that Nias got a red card in the 25th minute. So, you know, when you put those incidences kind of together and say that we were still able to get up over Watford 2-0, got the draw, you know, in the dying moments, like with you said, with the goalkeeping saved by Jakupovic, and then headed into that game with Sunderland at home, you would have really felt like there was, you know, we'd climbed somewhat of a mountain, and that was the kind of final hurdle. And, you know, really disappointing that we did take momentum into that game, which makes that result even more, all the more disappointing.
Absolutely. Any other closing thoughts? I suppose the other closing thought for this half of the season, I sort of touched on it before, but Bowen getting his full league debut in that final game of the season against Spurs, sort of reflecting the start of a new era in a way, because as we'll touch on in the next episode with Slutsky, you see, you know, your Tom Huddlestons, your Curtis Davies, your Elmer Hamady, Klukas, Robertson, there was a massive exodus that following season. So in a way, this half of the season really was the end of that golden era of the 2010s, and we're sort of into the sort of the revolving door, I suppose, of players that we experience over the next few seasons.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, these are strangely fond seasons because obviously it's a Premier League season, and so there's a little bit more, you know, attached to it. But the fact that it did, you know, come at a time where we were essentially filled with loanees, to be able to look back and reflect and still have some incredibly, you know, fond memories of these pop-up players, it's quite remarkable. You know, and in hindsight, a real shame that we weren't able to stay up. But as you said, fast forwarding, we know that you know, after that 7-1 Tottenham defeat, that was the birth of one Jarrod Bowen in his City career, and you know, from there we were able to build into what we've become now.
Absolutely. Yeah, so we've got a couple more seasons to go to wrap up this series on the decade that was the 2010s. So we'll be back some point to cover the next episode. But look, until then, thanks for joining me, Logan.
Yeah, my pleasure, Alex.
And thanks, everyone, for listening in. Until next time, come on, City.
You've been listening to the official Hull City Australia podcast, The Tigers Down Under.
For more discussion, join us on Facebook at the Hull City AFC Australia Facebook group, or follow us on Twitter at Hull City AFC Oz. The music was created by Amber Black.
There's no turning back 'cause you're out.